Welcome to Take a Deep Breath. Today's Breathcast guest is Louise Lloyd, and she wrote the book Stress Hacking, which you can see there, and you can pick that up in the description below or any good book retailer. And she wrote 50 Simple Strategies to Get Your Life, Your Mind, and Your Mojo Back. Had a wonderful conversation with Louise. She's been doing yoga for many years. She's a therapist, and she's just got one of those great holistic understandings of wellness. So I hope you get something from this podcast. I certainly did. We talked about stretching and healing and the way that we can use the mind to also help heal the body. So we went quite deep in this one. And I hope we get to do a part two at some stage as well, Louise. Thank you so much for your time. It was really appreciated. Guys, just a couple of quick messages before we do get stuck into the podcast. If you haven't done so already, please like, subscribe and share to our YouTube channel. We've got over 100 videos now dedicated to breath work. We also have Breathcast, which is our dedicated breath podcast. We've had some wonderful, wonderful guests on there so far. And we've got plenty lined up for 2021 as well. And then the last thing is just Instagram. So if you haven't done so, please use the link below. Pop on over to Instagram. Give us a bit of a like and a follow on there. We'd really appreciate it as well. We're really trying to grow that community. And we've got loads of content lined up for there. Enjoy the Breathcast, enjoy the podcast, enjoy the interview, and we'll see you again on the next one. Cheers. Good morning, everybody, and good morning, Louise. How are you doing today?
I'm very good, thank you. What about you, Mike?
Yeah, fantastic, thank you. It's a Sunday morning. I've got my cup of turmeric coffee in front of me here, and just starting to enjoy the weekend. So thank you so much for being on the Breathcast. Really excited to have a conversation with a fellow Brit as well. And I think you're the second Brit to be on the podcast after Dave. So wonderful to have you on here. So would you mind just, for our viewers, just give us a little bit of an explanation about who you are?
Sure. So basically what I do now is work with people, anything around managing the internal state, I guess, is the key aspect to it. My background in former life for me, I used to compete horses for my career. And that's when I got into, actually in the late 90s, totally out of the blue, I have to say, complete off my radar at the time. You know, in those days, competing, it wasn't like the whole mindset thing that we have today. So this sort of thing wasn't really out there at large, especially in the sport I was in. But bizarrely, I somehow decided to get interested in meditation was my first route in. And, you know, I know you've talked about things in your life that, you know, literally are life changing. And the meditation for me was completely life changing. And I guess as much as trying lots of different types of meditation, for me, the one thing that I always really resonated with was this connection to the breath. And so that's sort of been the foundation of my own meditative practice all over these years. But that, of course, starts you on a whole journey, doesn't it? And so from literally competing as my career, the meditation, I mean, I was married at the time, I had a literal transformation of getting out, if you like, of that entire life and getting interested in all things mindset, well-being, breathing, and taught yoga. I was practicing yoga, taught yoga, and obviously the breathing stuff and meditation that goes with that. Now it's more that I spend most of my time, well, when we're not in COVID scenario, I go into the workplace and work with people on anything from managing stress, which obviously the internal state being key part of that, to, you know, what they're doing at work, life goals, all the rest of it. So in all that, I think the key thread for me is the breath. So I'm really pleased to, you know, A, be here chatting to you today. So thank you for having me on. And B, to see, you know, what you're doing even on your channel of bringing all these different types of breath practice to a wide audience, I think is amazing.
Oh, thank you. And yeah, and you know, I appreciate your time as well. I think it's such a wonderful thing. I think I mentioned this when I had the Breathcast with Patrick McEwen of the Oxygen Advantage. It's over the last 10 years, I think it's been growing and growing and growing. Then you've had people like Wim Hof come in and it seems to just exploded now, this thing called breath work. And I'm so excited just to see where we are in another couple of years time with it as well, because it's just constantly going. I'm really keen to understand this. So mid late 90s, you discover meditation and breath work. How did you discover it? What did you come across? And what was the thing that brought you there?
You know, bizarrely, I mean, I was in that stage of my life at the time. I was extremely focused on my competitive career, quite impatient, quite driven. And sometimes these things just get in our way, don't they, on purpose? And I remember, I mean, quite weirdly, I was going to Tesco's one day doing my shopping and in a hurry, as I always was in those days. And I came out and every car in the car park had got a leaflet on the windscreen and not mine. Now, here's the funny thing. If one had been on my windscreen, I can guarantee I would have just screwed it up without even looking at it because I was too busy. And somehow, you know, these callings kind of come along, don't they? Bizarrely, because mine did not have one on. Yeah. I took one off the next car. See what it was. And it was for some people that did some alternative healing stuff, some meditation groups, or, you know, I think they did a range of let's call it alternative things. And one of the things on the leaflet, it said about having increased energy, calm, focus. And I don't know, something within me then, I think I was probably looking for something else that I didn't realize at the time, but certainly my intent of reading that was great. Well, this can help me focus more, have more energy, you know, for my career and all the rest of it. And of course, little did I know that once I'd start to get into that, you start to develop a level of self-awareness, which I have to say it continues to evolve for me. And from that point on, it's like you can't unknow what you now experience and know. So that for me, it was a real, you know, as we often say, it sounds a cliche and a bit corny to say totally changed my life. But I think that experience of meditation and the breath stuff in those early days totally put me on a completely different trajectory, and I feel one that I'm now meant to be on, you know.
I love that, yeah, because I'm the same. If something was on the windscreen, I might glance at it, but I wouldn't pay much attention. But if it wasn't there, I'd be thinking, hang on, why have I been missed out? What's going on here? So that's really interesting, that almost reverse way of you being brought into it. I find that, yeah, when you become aware of these things, it is a bit of a game changer. I spoke before about when I got back into my first corporate meeting after I'd come from the Wim Hof retreat. And there was a lot of stress going on in that meeting. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm so shallow with my breathing. Whereas in the past sort of 35 years, I've never even considered shallow breathing, panic breathing, all those different things. So yeah, it is a bit of a, you take that matrix pill, don't you? And you go down that route of discovery. What led you to become the yoga instructor?
Well, again, from meditation. So when I first got into meditation, with not too much practice at all, I have to say, in terms of the time that I was doing it, literally within weeks, I started to really feel incredible peace that I didn't even realize I was not peaceful until I experienced it within the level of meditation. And so that got me a little bit hooked in, as these things do, don't they? When you start to feel totally different and better in yourself, you want more of that. Yeah. So I started to meditate more and more and more. And then what started to happen for me in meditation was not just the fact that I felt incredibly calm, peaceful, connected, and all the other things that you can experience in that, but I started to get these insights and just, I guess, aha moments. And one of the things that started to come to me was teach yoga. And I have to say, at that time, I pushed it away because I didn't even practice yoga, other than obviously the breathing stuff and the meditation side of it. But I certainly didn't do the posture side of it. And it, you know, every time I sat down, Mike, it just wouldn't go away. So in the end, I'd started to learn to just follow these insights and inklings a little bit and see where they took me. And so I thought, okay, then I'll do it. So I started to A, practice yoga, and then B, train to teach it. Wow. So that really led me into that. And I have to say, teaching yoga taught me so much more about the breath, because I found it absolutely fascinating watching the way people were breathing when they weren't away. You're watching them breathing. Yes. And it really highlighted to me the world that we live in today. We have created so much of this, you know, ongoing slight fight or flight reactive way of living, and that many people, because of that, are in this really shallow breathing without even knowing that there's another way to breathe. And that was really obvious to me. And I know we talked about this before we hit record here, but again, something for me, I had no idea that I had a pattern of what we would call reverse, or I think you called it something else the other day, reverse breathing.
And, yeah, paradoxical breathing, I think it's called.
Yeah, which is, you know, when you know, as we breathe in, if naturally we're breathing in our most efficient way, the diaphragm's yes. moving down as we breathe in.
Yes.
So the belly would move out a little bit, and then the reverse of that on the exhalation. And what I was doing is the total opposite, is when I was breathing in, my belly was moving in a little bit, and then
yes.
I don't think mine really came out much at all. It just sort of got sucked in a bit. So until I started really the breath awareness and the yoga, I had no idea that I was doing that. I did, you know, I was aware that I was highly driven.
Yes.
And I think some, you know, I've noticed a pattern with people that have that reverse breathing, that they can quite often be, they're quite driven, they're quite, can be quite hard on themselves. Mm. So lots of kind of psychological things around it as well. And I really started to notice a pattern of that with the people in the yoga classes as well.
Okay, so I'm really excited to get into this with you, because this is hot topic for me right now, because I had Belissa Varanic on a couple of weeks ago, and she was the first one to introduce that concept to me of this paradoxical breathing or reverse breathing. And I was like, oh Jesus, I'm doing that all the time. So I do the breathing exercises, and I'm, you know, learning the power of the nose. So what tips can you give to break this condition? And I'll just give it a little bit more, because for me, I think it's a piece of I started working in the pubs years ago, and I was like 14, 15, and suddenly I had unlimited supply of chips and cake around me. So it was really easy to put on extra body weight and put body fat on. So I started sucking in the, you know, the stomach. And that was like age 14, age 15. I can remember it and thinking, oh, that's all right now. And that's continued for sort of 20 years. And now recently I'm like, right, I need to be aware of this. But as I'm walking down the street, or, you know, whatever, I'm thinking, oh, I'm sucking in again, relax. And I'm struggling to break that conditioning. So I'm sure there's other people, because it's quite a common issue. So can you share a little bit about what you did to kind of break that?
Sure. Yeah. And it's interesting you say about that, with the kind of, you know, pulling your stomach in for what it was looking like, because I think that's one of the key things is, you know, A, there's that. So standing, you know, pulling yourself together, we've got that saying, haven't we? Or just pull yourself together and stand up, you know, and a lot of that, of course, is really great in terms of thinking about your posture to help, you know, not slouching and all the rest of it. But there's something psychologically quite different, isn't there, of pulling your stomach in to look a little bit thinner, or pulling yourself together if you're feeling something's a bit tough. And, you know, certainly for me, I think if I stem it back a little bit to posture stuff as well, spending so long riding horses was very much about strong core, sitting up, a good posture. And I know I used to really, the same as you, kind of pull the belly in as part of kind of strength and core and all the rest of it. And if we think about that, you know, even if you go and exercise, a key thing, especially with Pilates, is about pulling this stomach in. And that's great for protection of the spine in those, you know, postures when we're exercising to a degree. But if we then lock on and hold that, I think that can start to bring this pattern in. So how did I get out of it myself? I think first of all, the awareness was key. And then I personally, the only way I could do it was to separate, to begin with, movement of my stomach going outwards and inwards that was nothing connected to the breath. If I tried to connect it with the breath, for me, that pattern was so ingrained. I just got, it was a bit like the patting your head, rubbing your tummy and getting in and off with it, right? Yeah. So what I did to start with is I literally put my hands on my belly.
Yep.
And without thinking of breathing, I pushed my stomach out, like literally using my stomach muscles to push my belly out. And then I let it relax and sort of drop back in. And I do that 5 or 6 times. And I have to say, even just doing that non-breath related, I felt tremendous discomfort in the diaphragm area, but I worked with it. And then the next stage of that was I pushed the belly out whilst taking a breath in. Okay. And I wouldn't think about the exhalation. I just let that happen fairly naturally. And I repeated that for quite a long time until that breathing in with the belly moving out became more natural. Now, of course, I'm not suggesting here that it's the intention to forever use your stomach muscles to push out and pull in to help you to breathe. But for me, it was the only way I could break that pattern.
Yes.
And then having broken that pattern, it became much more natural that I could do it in a more relaxed way. The other thing that I used to do, I'm quite a visual person, so I used to literally visualize the diaphragm moving downwards as I was breathing in. And I found that that helped me to unlock a little bit the diaphragm because, you know, the diaphragm, again, coming back to the psychological side of all of this, it's right in the solar plexus area, isn't it? So for me, what I really noticed is, again, that tension, you know, on all levels. I had no idea I kept mentally, emotionally. But when I started to work with the diaphragm moving a little bit more, I could literally feel how tense I was on all those levels. And I had no awareness of that before at all. So I think once you start to work with it in that way, that's key. Now, I'd add to that, and something totally I hadn't connected until listening to your podcast with Patrick McKeon the other week, the nasal breathing. I've really noticed that if you focus on breathing through the nose and not breathing through the mouth, there's a natural switch on of the diaphragm moving in a more efficient way by nasal breathing. So I was really interested and pleased to hear him saying about this, you know, when with the best will in the world, you know, when we say, and different people saying, oh, you know, calm, take a deep breath, I thought it was fantastic where he really highlighted that point of, yeah, but just taking a deep breath isn't enough, because if you're taking a deep breath and you're still in upper chest breathing, you're just deepening an already not great pattern.
Yeah.
So it is that connection of, you know, perhaps breathing through the nose, having the awareness, if it really helps, just to have your hands resting lightly on your stomach, to have that felt sensation, as well as maybe a visual sensation of whether the belly's actually moving outwards as you're breathing in. If the belly's moving outwards as you're breathing in, the chances are your diaphragm is moving down when you're breathing in.
Yeah.
So lots of different things. I know different things help for different people to get that.
Yes. No, that's really good. So just focus on letting the belly go out. And I really like that piece around the visualization of the diaphragm. So I'm going to practice those bits. So thank you. That because I've been thinking, right, just, you know, relax the belly, but then you forget about it and suddenly you go back and you're aware and you're like, oh, it's sucked back in again. That's really interesting. And it's almost like a vanity thing as well. So that's really good. I found, through the Oxygen Advantage training that, they talk a lot, nasal breath will help with the diaphragm. That being said, I took part in a Soma breathwork exercise when I interviewed Niraj, and it's the end of that podcast, and I watched it back and I was horrified because even though it was breathing, I was and it's almost as exaggerated as that. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then when I spoke to Belissa Vranic, she was saying, get the diaphragm right first.
Yeah.
Because and I think I don't think it's one or the other, but I think for me personally, for maybe some other people, it's let's get that diaphragm working. Because she was saying actually mouth or nose breathing, you know, if the diaphragm's not moving properly, if that's stuck. So I don't think I realized how much of an epidemic or it is or was with people, this kind of sucking of the stomach. And I'm wondering now, it probably affects a big percentage of people, these paradoxical breathing. I think the study that the Belissa was referencing is like 80% of people are doing some sort of stucking. Is there anything else that you've come across in yoga that would help with this? Are there any particular stretches or moves?
Posture in general, I think, is key, and just that self-awareness. I mean, so I noticed when I was teaching yoga, people lying in relaxation, for example, when they think, you know, they're just at the end of practice and they're having those few minutes at the end of practice, I would watch people breathing at that time. And I would notice, I mean, I could literally pick the people out in the room that suffered from anxiety or stress by just watching them breathe when they're lying down. So I think, first of all, having that awareness of it is key. Posture to a degree, but recognizing, as you've said, this pulling the stomach in, which can often be related to thinking you're holding better posture. I think the key thing is this: hands on the belly, and even if you have to separate it first by using the stomach muscles to push outwardly to at least give space for the diaphragm to move down. Because the other thing, of course, is if really we're pulling the abdominal wall in tightly, we're holding the stomach in. That doesn't really allow the diaphragm to move down and push the organs below it out a little bit. So I think even just though it's not the intent to then forever use the stomach muscles to push outwardly, at least doing that breaks that pattern and also allows the space for the diaphragm to move down. It is interesting. And I think the taking a deep breath, as you said, you know, I do this in the workplace on when I'm doing stuff around stress management, and I'll get people to put their hands on their belly, and then either, you know, when we're doing it, they either close their eyes or just soften their gaze. And I just say, I don't explain what I'm looking for at this point, but I just say, well, see if we can notice which way the belly's moving when you're breathing. And of course, I'm watching everybody in the room. And what I can say is that a lot of people, when I go around and say, right, what was yours doing? Most people will say, my belly was moving out when I was breathing in and in when I was breathing out. And actually the reality is that wasn't happening at all. The reality, from a visual perspective at least, is that their shoulders were going up when they were breathing in and the shoulders were going down when they were breathing out. Now, I think we can confuse that feeling with the stomach moving in and out because it's what we know. And that's quite interesting to statistics if it's sort of around 80%. That wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact number, but I remember being horrified at how high it was. When you say that you could see the people lying down in the yoga studio, what were the signs that they may have anxiety and depression? Was it just the breathing of the belly? Was there other things?
So there was no movement in the belly at all when they were breathing. And still, even though they were lying down, there was a slight contraction upwards in the shoulders, minimal because they were on the floor, but it was sort of gravitating slightly up towards the ears and then dropping again, but quite a held tension in the shoulders. And I think, again, you know, in the workplace, many people perhaps know that their posture's not great. If they sit at a desk all day and they're, you know, looking at screens all day, they might be aware that they're not in a great posture. But they probably over time aren't aware that there's just a very slight upward grip in the shoulders pretty much constantly. Now, you know, if you think about when we're wanting maximum breath, we would recruit the shoulder muscles to help us to breathe in those instances. So, you know, the diaphragm being the main muscle and a few around the ribs that sort of help that as like the heart would work, you know, relentlessly without tiring. But the shoulder muscles would be recruited at times of extra need. But what, of course, we've done is we've come into that we're using them because we're in upper chest breathing, we're using them all the time. So the other thing that you notice in yoga is in people's posture and how they hold any of the poses within the practice is this general tension in the shoulders. And that, you know, as much as they might go and have that sorted out, you know, they might go and have a massage or they might go to physio or this sort of thing. If they don't correct that breathing pattern, it's always going to be there. So that again comes back to that efficient use of the diaphragm, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's really, you're the first yoga instructor I've had on Breathcast, actually. So this is very interesting. What are your thoughts on trapped emotions in tightness? Have you got any kind of history of that or any advice on that?
Yeah, huge. I mean, that's that, you know, I've seen so much evidence of that. And, you know, even in terms of the yoga practice, moving the body, we're connected with the breathing. It was very common in a yoga class to have one or two people in, you know, frequently that would just be shedding a few tears in the relaxation at the end. And this is just, I think that, you know, the body, there's a book, isn't there, by Gabor Mate. Is it The Body Keeps Score? I read it some time ago. Fascinating book, but basically just about, you know, everything that we experience, everything we go through, the body keeps track of that. It holds it somewhere. And we know that we suppress emotions that we find difficult, thoughts that we find difficult. So I think the breath work and the yoga, the stretching, exercise in general is really good at helping us to move those through. And, you know, in fact, for people that have been through severe trauma, sometimes movement therapy is the way that they can start to release that suppressed trauma without having to have a conversation about it when that's too difficult. So yeah, huge. I think that the breath is key for releasing some of those too.
Yeah. Have you personally experienced any of that? Have you done any Wim Hof or any holotropic-esque stuff? Because I've had some big releases through that.
I haven't done the Wim Hof stuff myself, other than I've tried a bit of the breath off my own back. I haven't done his training. I've done cold shower stuff as well. Mm. What I would say in terms of, I've done quite a lot of different pranayama things over the years from the breathing that would be similar, and also a different, I don't know if you've come across transformational breathing.
No, the name is familiar, but I wouldn't know what it was.
Yeah, so that's more, I mean, that's the opposite of nasal breathing, in that you breathe through your mouth.
Right.
And you are, your focus is on the inhalation, and you almost have a minimal, if at all, exhalation. That gets you into quite a whole altered state, and is there in for that intention of releasing quite a few things. I've done several courses on that years ago, and there was, without doubt, in a room full of, you know, 10, 12 people, most of us went through some kind of emotional release as a part of bringing that breath stuff on. What about you through your the Wim Hof stuff with that side of things?
Yeah, so I've done Wim Hof, and I've also done a version of biodynamic breath work, which is similar to, I think, what you've just mentioned there. So with the Wim Hof piece, it was, we did, I think, an hour or an hour and a half of the deep breathing. And I've mentioned this before, but, you know, I went into a ball of laughter, then there was tears streamed down my face, there was other people in the room, and I think we did three or four of these big breathwork sessions, and you've got Wim just walking around you, screaming, you know, deeply in, let it go. And that was a big, big release. I remember at one point a chap looked over, who we're really good friends with now, and he says, what's going on? Why are you so upset? And I was like, no, I was absolutely fine, because you were really crying. So I wasn't even aware of one of them. But then fast forward a year, 2 years, and I did this biodynamic breathwork session, similar-ish to Wim Hof in some ways, but no retentions, no pauses. And so it was just an hour of this reciprocal breathing, just going in and out, and nothing came out. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if it was excreted, is the wrong word, sounds awful. I wonder if it came out in the Wim Hof session, and that trapped emotion of sort of 35 years came out there, and nothing's been able to build up yet since. So I don't know, have you come across that, people, they have a big release and then a couple of weeks later there's nothing, or it happens a few times?
What I would say is, I love the idea of that, and I'm sure for some people that might be the case. I think perhaps the reality is, in my experience anyway, is that what happens is, over time, we go to deeper and deeper layers of that. Mm. So we might release all that's there at that point, but, you know, in my experience at least, life will come around a bit further down the road and shift another layer of that. And, you know, I think it's about moving back as much as possible to this state of being that is much more peaceful and loving and generous. And I think that what, you know, life's experiences, we get into these contracted state around that. Now, what, you know, I'm not saying, of course, as a normal human being, we've got this nervous system that is very much meant to be fight and flight reactive in situations that's warranted. I think that the difficulty is now is that many people, you know, we're in that without even knowing that we're in that fight or flight reactive as our normal state. Mm. I was very interested listening to you in your chat with Dave when you were describing about your getting into the cold and you're managing to, from that contracted state, that you manage to let go and relax into that. Now, to me, this is where the breath is in everyday life has so much potential. Yeah. Because imagine if we go through our day-to-day lives and instead of accumulating that tension from, you know, that conversation you've just had, or right now, you know, in the middle of the COVID going on, of, you know, the uncertainty and change for everybody. Imagine if in an ongoing way, we could just keep using the breath to turn down that fight or flight reactivity, come back to homeostasis, back into that rest, digest, repair part of our nervous system, that mostly then we've got that ability to shift state. Like, imagine the effects of that on us on every level, because when we go into that contracted state, you know, it's not just even about the physical harm that that's causing us because of that, but we're so much more restricted as a human being. And yet it's something as simple as the breath that we take with us can make such a difference.
Yes. Yeah, it's a little superpower that we have here that we don't utilize enough of. And I remember there was maybe 6 months after I did the Wim Hof retreat, I foolishly signed up for a abseil where you come down a building, and it's for charity. Again, I'm not the sort of person that I would have said in the past would do things like that. And I had a little GoPro on my head, and I didn't even know that I was doing it. I was terrified, and there was just this bit where I was like... There's a really long exhale, and then I went off over the back, and I did it. Yeah. And there's just this piece of, I doubled the exhale without even knowing it. I relaxed my body, and I was able to then do something scary, whereas I was so kind of, you know, terrified before. And then fast forward again to kind of last year, it was always on my bucket list to it sounds stupid as hell. I always wanted to jump off a cliff into some water, because again, it's the sort of thing that I wouldn't be able to do as a kid. I was too scared, especially cold water, although this wasn't cold. And so again, same sort of thing, that the breathing's been with me since those days of Wim Hof. And it is that little superpower of, if you can take a moment and get yourself out of freeze or flight. But I think it's freezes a lot of time. We have a problem with that one, don't we? We just need to exhale out and then start the breathing process again. Where has the breath helped you in your day-to-day life? Can you give some examples of maybe times where you've used the knowledge of breath? Has anything come to mind?
Oh, loads. I mean, so for me, the most life-changing thing, and as simple as it sounds, is what I call literally just a single breath practice. And that is, in everyday life, all day, as often as I can remember, to just take one deep conscious breath, paying attention to my inhale, paying attention to the exhale, and using that as a check-in first of all, to make sure I'm really present in the moment that I'm in.
Yes.
But then also to try to notice, what state of being am I in? Oh, so I notice, you know, now my posture's not great, or yes, I've gone a bit tense, or, you know, I'm thinking about something else, or whatever it might be. But for me now, having practiced that for so many years, it's like a switch of, all right, okay, now I'm here. What state am I in? And then the ability to mostly, not always, but mostly, to be able to shift state if I need to in the moment. And that for me has been life-changing. I have to say, you know, when I go and teach all this stuff around breath stuff, meditation, stress management, I think people can get the impression that I've just always been fairly centered, grounded, calm. That's not the case at all. Like, I can be the most massive overthinker. I'm quite passionate and emotional as a person, so I could be incredibly reactive. And so for me, actually, when I first got into all of this, one of the biggest revelations and uses in daily life was that I could take a few deep breaths and slow down being so overreactive. Yeah. You know, And that's not just life-changing for me, that's life-changing for the people that have to live around me. Yeah. So I think in everyday life, you know, especially when we're under stress or we're under pressure, it's almost becomes our default to get a little bit overreactive. Our nervous system is designed to do that. But if we can interrupt that and just take those few deep breaths, for me personally, in everyday life moments, it's been that. So that's one of the first things I would say. Secondly, three years ago, I split up with my second husband, and that was really difficult. The breath was literally a lifesaver in terms of, you know, dealing with those incredibly intense emotions and pain, and just to be able to use the breath as a tool to help navigate that. So, you know, that for me in everyday life as well is quite key of, life is difficult at times.
Yes.
You know, that it's part of us being alive on earth, that we are going to go through stuff that's extremely challenging, and that's all right. You know, it's about having the tools to be able to navigate it. So for me, that ability to, you know, let's say when I split up with my husband, there'll be moments where I'd suddenly have a something would remind me of him. I'd be out and about. And literally, I'd never had panic attacks before, but I started to get on that feeling it was going to be an overwhelm of emotion. And just the ability to be able to go, you know, to knowing what was happening in my body, to be able to say to myself, breathe, it's all right, it'll pass, literally stopped me going into having panic attacks. So I think on that tool, it's been useful as well. And the ability to sit and meditate and sit in the breath to let difficult things get processed. And I think, again, that's perhaps one of the things we struggle with in day-to-day life is when we're all so busy, when are we processing normal human thoughts, feelings, and emotions? So both in the moment of being able to take a deep breath when in it, but also for me, the ability to be able to have a little bit of time to breathe, to meditate, to let those feelings, thoughts, whatever's going on, just pass through.
Yeah, it's so important. And I will go through long phases of just being distracted and then realizing, Jesus, I've not had any time to myself for weeks or sometimes months. Because I'll have my day job, then I'll be doing some stuff on Take a Deep Breath. So it's almost two full-time jobs, you know, you're working. And then I've recently, because we've moved house, started having baths, and oh my goodness, this ritual. I've only had a couple so far, but they've been little game changers for me, because I'm a big fan of the sauna. Absolutely adore the sauna, but no saunas are open right now. And I would go normally every day, and you'd often have conversations with people, so you wouldn't get that much time to yourself. But with the bath, I've noticed the candles go on, so I get a little bit of red light therapy. There's some salts and some lavender, and there's no phones, and it's just this candle light. Doesn't sound very manly, does it? I don't care, because it's not about that. It's this peace around just being in this room by yourself. And I notice that I'm getting all of these thoughts and processes going on that would normally happen before I try and go to sleep. So the nights that I do have those hot baths, I know there's stuff going on there with a hot bath anyway in a cool room, and that helps us sleep. But there was this extra piece of, I'm just kind of clearing everything out. And it was interesting, last week I had one. I started getting a bit anxious and a bit stressed, and all these thoughts came through. And I thought, that's okay, because they need to clearly come out, those thoughts. So that would be my bit of advice. And again, that's still a journey I'm going on right now, is we need to take time for ourselves, because I'm not a big fan of meditating. I like the breathing. I really struggle to make myself sit down and just you know, meditate. So do you have any tips around that? Is it, because for me, it's I'll do some breath work or go for a walk in nature. But if you ask me to sit in the corner or sit on the sofa and, you know, just close my eyes, it's one of the worst things for me to do.
Yeah, well, I think, to come into how much you've got going on in life for a start, I think this is a lot of, you know, busy. And I think this is why a lot of people struggle with meditation is, if we think about our brain waves, when you're really busy, and let's say you're in high beta brainwave state in your everyday life, you're, you know, mentally you're very thinking about a lot of things, juggling a lot of things. And then when we sit and meditate, to start with, we sit down and we start to pay attention, don't we, if we're meditating. And of course, well, the first thing we notice is just how busy our mind is. Now, I think people can have this preconception that meditation is all zen and, you know, and that you should be able to sit there and empty your mind of thoughts. Well, I don't see meditation as that myself. I see it as more of the perhaps the mindfulness meditation of just noticing what's there. And so I think if you first of all accept that it's highly likely when we first sit down that the mind will be incredibly busy. If you've got a really busy life, your mind is thinking of a lot of things. So, you know, I like to think of that of, you know, if you're driving along at 80, 90 miles an hour and then you suddenly stopped, it's best to take a bit of time to slow down.
Yes.
And yet we expect our mind to go from 80, 90 miles an hour to nothing. And we get very frustrated if it's not the case. So first of all, my guidance would be to say, just watch what's going on without judgment. This is for me where the breath is fantastic, because the breath starts to help to slow the mind down a little bit. So it creates, if you like, this transition into the slowing down of the brain waves a little bit more. And so I think it's really good to, certainly for myself, I always sit down and think about the breath first as a transition, both into and out of the practice. irrelevant of where it's going in the practice. So that would be my first thing. And then secondly, we have a judgment of which we prefer to feel. So I'm sure, you know, you may have experienced in some of your breathing practices that you have amazing states of being that you experience that feel great. So I think, again, it's our human nature to want more of those. And then when they don't come, we either feel we're doing something wrong or we've got this, you know, oh, well, this is a waste of time. And if you just think of it as that a meditation practice is about processing whatever's there, noticing whatever's there, and to try to cultivate this non-judgmental awareness of just watching what shows up. So I'm watching that my mind is busy, for example. Mm. I'm watching that I'm frustrated with my mind being busy. I'm noticing that I'd sooner get up and do something else, and it feels really uncomfortable right now to sit. Like, that to me is a bit the same as you were describing about that getting in the cold water. Is, you know, instinct and every fiber of your being and mind says, get out. This is awful.
Yep.
And yet, if you can relax into that, something shifts.
That's something really interesting. Shifts. That's really interesting.
The meditation is a bit the same.
Yeah, I love that comparison with going into a cold ice bath being like meditation. Because actually, when you say that out loud, and I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking, oh, it does feel, because I want to jump out of that. If you put me in a seat now and say, right, meditate, I can go in there and I can brace, but I'm trying to jump out as quickly as I can. Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. That's really
good. And I'm not saying, you know, I'm certainly not saying that meditation is for everyone. You know, I'm very much a believer of each to their own, and we all find our different routes. But what I find interesting about meditation, and why I personally feel it's so useful, particularly in today's world, is that we have become addicted to avoiding or distracting ourselves away from the slightest discomfort.
Yes.
We've got so much distraction available for us that we never have to sit, if we didn't want to, with what is. And so I think there's tremendous scope for learning to do that in meditation, to be with ourselves in a more loving, non-judgmental way, and as part of processing normal everyday life. And I have to say, I think that's huge potential for us to learn to do that. Certainly in my own experience, I've really, it's interesting, I've noticed, particularly in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, that having learned, and bear in mind I've been meditating since the 90s now, it's taken me quite a long journey here or there to go through all of those frustrations, I'm sitting down today and I'm feeling really uncomfortable or mentally busy, or I haven't got time for this. You know, I go through all of that. But what I've noticed, particularly of late, is that the ability to learn to sit with my own discomfort, whatever that might be, whether that's physical pain, emotional pain or mental pain, to be able to sit with that and breathe, has really enabled me to be able to sit with others that are in that space without me getting drawn into, or, I think sometimes when we sit with other people that are in discomfort in whatever that might be, we feel an urge to want to make it better.
Yes.
It feels uncomfortable for us and we don't like them suffering. But this ability that I've learned through breathing and meditation to be able to sit with my own discomfort is helping me to be able to sit in non-judgmental, compassionate space with others that are in pain. And that, again, is a tool, I think.
Yeah. And if you take that further, so what does that mean? Because I feel like if somebody's in pain, it's my job to try and fix things for them, you know, if they're having problems with their career or personal life. So is it about acknowledging that and letting them ask you for help? What does that look like?
Well, I think that, first of all, I think, you know, there's a great healing and benefit, I think, for us all to feel like we've genuinely been heard. Okay. And in my experience before, because I used to be so uncomfortable with other people suffering, and I'm very, very much a proactive person, so I it would be almost at fault of me to want to jump in and, like you say, make it better, you know, remove suffering and the rest of it. But in doing so, I'm not sure I always fully honoured or gave space for the acknowledgement of somebody to just be where they are.
Yes.
And so I think, you know, because I felt so uncomfortable, perhaps with people being uncomfortable, it almost became as much about me as it was about them without me intending it to be that way. So there is something around this just, you know, the ability to be truly present in the moment with somebody. We have to be able to sit with whatever's there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then from that space, you know, when I'm coaching with people, you know, often if you hold that space for people, they find their own answers.
Yeah, that's the beauty of coaching, isn't it? We spend way too much time in tell, don't we? We don't spend enough time just listening, asking the questions. It's just our nature today to be able to fill that space. We don't like to have that empty space, do we? Mm.
No, and I think, again, just coming back to what we said a moment ago, I think our tendency in today's world, particularly with mobile technology, is we just distract ourselves all the time. Yeah. So I think there's something also about helping people to find this steady space.
Yeah.
That might just be because they're sat with you and they're just, there's something around the energy of that.
Mm.
And again, I think that's the great thing about all these different breath practices is that they all can bring different states of being, can't they? Depending what we want.
Yeah. Let me get a bit deeper with you now then. Let me ask. So I've noticed that, I'm just going to adjust the camera because it looks like I'm much shorter than you and I'm standing up. It's quite funny. I'm on a standing desk now. We talked about posture earlier. This has been a bit of a game changer for me as well, because you spend 8-10 hours a day sitting. It's not good for you, is it? So I'm trying to get used to this. And it was only a couple of weeks ago, I was like, why am I so tired? I'm not even exercising that much at the minute. I was like, oh, because you're standing 8 hours a day, you plonker. Anyway, so I've noticed recently, and this coincides actually with the bath thing we were talking about earlier, that I realised that I haven't had a good cry for a couple of years. And although nothing's going on consciously, when I'm in the bath, I do feel like, oh, a good cry would sort things out, but I can't get it to happen. And I was thinking, do you know what? I think we miss out on a huge part of our emotions because we hold all that stuff in, don't we? Oh, we don't want to cry unless something really bad's happened and then it all comes out, doesn't it? And I think back to, I've seen some documentaries about, I think there was like a funeral somewhere in Africa and everyone's wailing for days and they're just letting it all out. And then you look at something that happens in the UK and we're very stern and we keep it all suppressed and we have to stay strong for people, don't we? I would love to know your thoughts on crying, if you've got any, and you know, releasing of these emotions.
Yeah, well, I think you know, crying is, at the end of the day, there's a reason that we have it in our design to do it. And so, as you rightly say, you know, there's this tendency at times to suppress it, to be supposedly strong. I think we're learning more and more now that in fact that's not great for us to do.
Yeah.
So how, you know, the fact that you come quite close to it, I think in your situation that you're creating at the moment with having a bath, for example, you're creating the right environment to let go, I guess is the way of thinking of it, because sometimes these emotions are there and we're not intending to hold them in. So you're not intentionally trying not to cry, for example. However, it's habitual to just not cry, perhaps.
Yeah.
So it's somehow setting up the right environment. And I think that, you know, even it might be watching a film, be that, you know, something that might be a bit sad or something on the other side that's really heart-opening and heartwarming can make us cry. So that can be a way in for people if they feel that they've got some suppressed emotion, is to do it through what I call a kind of third party.
Yes.
You know, to be able to just get those floodgates open and by watching a film, it's not directly related to our own life, but it will help that clearing.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, that might just be that if it's holding this loving space for yourself as well. I think there's something around that in just, you know, I call it becoming our own best friend self, of almost holding that loving, caring, encouraging, but let's have a real honest chat here with ourselves.
Yes. Yeah. and not be worried about embarrassment and and all these. It's fascinating to me how each culture has its own way of dealing with emotions. And I don't think we're down a very healthy path right now with all this suppression. It's going to come back and bite us later on in life, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, there's more and more. Gabor Mate, I think that I mentioned earlier, his book and a lot of his studies around this, how we have suppressed emotions and literally they've been able to fairly accurately pinpoint the chronic health conditions people would have based on their personality and their style of suppressing emotions. It's quite incredible to see how accurate a prediction they can make with that. So this whatever we can do to release emotions. And I think that within that also, there's a balance of when to do that. So it's really helpful, for example, this, you know, I mentioned earlier about this internal state and being able to shift it. It's really helpful if you've just got to go into a meeting at work, for example, and something's just triggered you and you're feeling quite emotional. It's really helpful for that not to be the moment, perhaps, for that all to surface. So to be able to, whatever it might be for you, you know, for me, it might be taking a few deep breaths, adjusting my posture, focusing on the intent of what's about to happen and what I need to be present for. And then to come back to that later, when it's the right place, when it's the right time. You know, for me, that's in meditation, breathing, going for a walk around nature. Really, that's a great place for me also to process stuff. So the ability to do both, the ability to create the right environments to let these emotions surface, difficult thoughts. You know, when we experience things in life, it's not about being strong not to feel those things.
Yes.
You know, it's part of being human to experience all of it. And I really don't think what we're looking for is to not feel that pain or that discomfort. Really what we're looking for is a way to navigate it and to be able to do that in a way that's helpful.
Yeah. It's terrifying to me. Obviously, my main reference point is Britain. You know, I've been to other countries, but obviously I've grown up here. Just how suppressed I find people. My partner, she's from Poland, and it's different there. You know, they've still got it's a European country. I just find that maybe a bit more direct in the way that they speak, and you tend to find that you know where people are coming from more. Where I found in the corporate workplace, which I've got, you know, this sort of 15, 16 years now, it's sometimes really hard to identify where people's emotions are, and then you end up misinterpreting it as well. I'm really keen to understand some of the work you've done in the corporate world. What are you doing there? What are your findings? If you give us an oversight, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I go in and work with either groups or individuals on anything, literally, from managing stress, the well-being choices, self-awareness, and that's you know, right the way through to managing pressure and uncertainty, dealing with change, all of those things. But for me, it comes back to the same thing, all of it. It's about the more self-awareness we've got, the more tools we've got to be able to navigate this internal state. And what I mean by that is, you know, our physical, mental and emotional well-being, and also mindset and the behaviours that come from that. But when we've got the ability to manage that a little bit better, I mean, it becomes a win-win because A, we can navigate these normal things that we go through as human beings.
Yes.
But B, the knock-on effect of that is a better result. So, you know, even thinking about, you were saying about people in the workplace and emotions and, you know, so when we're in the workplace and we're trying to be professional and yet something is riling us or getting us stressed, you know, then we know that we have this, what we call displaced aggression, where you get in the car and, well, if you are now back in the workplace, you know, but certainly pre-COVID, you know, there's a bit of road rage that you have with somebody you don't even know. Or you go home and you're a bit snappy with loved ones.
Yeah.
This is just displaced aggression where we've not really handled the moment that we felt it was inappropriate to deal with that feeling there and then.
Yes.
Now, I'm not saying that we should then start, you know, getting aggressive in the workplace in those moments. What I mean is acknowledging we've had that shift in our internal state and being able to move through it there and then rather than it's suppressed until later.
I remember I was in a management training course and it was, this is years ago now, they're like, why did the little girl kick the cat?
And it went all the, have you heard that? And it goes all the way to the top where the CEO shouted at somebody, and it went all the way down. And then the mum shouts at the little girl, and she kicks the cat. And it just reminds me of what you were saying there. This, we kind of suppress it in because we've had a problem at work, and then it flows out somewhere else with your partner or with your friends or internally, doesn't it? So what can people do there then? How can we deal with that?
I think there's two things. I think the key thing is, first of all, to try to develop a little bit more self-awareness. I genuinely do not believe people go out of their way to try and make everyone else's day worse. It is literally just that often a lack of self-awareness, particularly when we are in that fight or flight reactivity. We don't, you know, so often other people see that we're not right, but we don't see it in ourselves. And I think particularly in the world that we live in, we've normalized stress so much.
Yes.
That, you know, it's like, well, that's life, isn't it? No, it isn't life. It doesn't have to be. It's how we navigate it. So, and I don't say that lightly, because I know people have an incredible amount to deal with. But self-awareness, first of all, just to know yourself a bit better and how stress affects you, I think is key. And then, honestly, this is why I'm so excited to see the work you're doing, is the more awareness we can have around the simple things like breathing.
Yes.
You know, it's because I get it. People don't have loads of time, you know, but even 10 minutes of a breath practice daily.
Yes.
Can totally be a game changer. So, you know, for people that then say to me, I haven't got time for that. I'm like, seriously, how have you not got time for that?
Yes.
Because the mucking up in your life that's going on without managing your state. So taking a bit of time to do a more formal breath practice, whatever that might be, and you've got loads on your site that people can try on this channel. And then also just in that ongoing way, as I say, that single breath practice doesn't take any time at all.
No, I love that. I'm going to be trying that as well.
Yeah. The thing is, it's about using that to get present, and then
yes.
That cannot help but influence all the choices you make moment to moment, whether that's what you're about to eat, that conversation you're about to have, the choice you're about to make. You know, when you take that deep breath and get present, it can't help but influence that.
Yeah, even just talking about it and then doing it. I was recording a breathwork exercise yesterday, actually. And even though I live and breathe this, I was just doing some slow breathing for the camera. And I was like, oh, I feel so relaxed. You forget sometimes, even though you talk about it, when you're doing it again and again, you're like, oh. And you know, I love that idea of just that single check-in breath, because it's just something so simple. And you're right, we don't give ourselves enough time to heal and look after ourselves because we're too busy. But really, what are we busy with? We're scrolling. I don't know if you've come across this documentary on Netflix that's just come out. I think it's called The Social Dilemma.
I watched it.
Oh, the way that they've engineered us to just spend more and more time swiping and make it as addictive as possible. Having that knowledge, and by the way, guys, if you haven't seen that and you can get Netflix, go and check that Social Dilemma out, because it's a bit of a tool, I think, now, because now that I know that that's been built in that way, it gives me a bit of a power to go, oh, I know what's happening here now. I can step away from that, because actually I know what they're trying to do to get me to keep scrolling. But no, this piece around just taking that time to yourself, you know, this stuff is mainly free, and it's the sort of exercises that you don't need any special training to do. We can all take a slow, deep breath in through the nose. We can hold for a few seconds, and we can extend the exhale out. And, you know, you do that a couple of times, you're in a very different place, aren't you, from where you were a couple of minutes ago?
Yeah, and I think that's the key thing, Mike. I think, you know, with all of this, it can often feel really overwhelming, that people just think, oh, you know, I love the idea of those things, but A, they might not work for me, and B, I haven't got time for them. But actually, it's the really simple little things that we can just action.
Yes.
Like if we could just get into the habit of actioning something.
Yes.
It's going to change something else. So, and remembering with that single breath practice, you know, it doesn't often feel like we've got a choice, but we've always got a choice in what we're bringing into that moment. We've always Yes. got that choice, even Yeah. when, especially right now in the middle of COVID-19 stuff, that so much seems to be beyond our control. It's easy to forget that those few deep breaths, and just remembering we can choose what we're bringing to life, suddenly we feel a bit more empowered about all those things.
Yes. It's this wonderful thing if we have conscious breath. and we can take that moment in a chaotic universe. But you're right, we have that control over how we choose to breathe, which is so powerful. I'm really interested, Louise, to know a bit about your routine. So what do you do daily, weekly, monthly? Can you give us an idea about what your morning routines might look like, evening routines?
Yeah, sure. So I started a while back. Really, for me, I'm a morning person predominantly, and I really do like that quiet time early. So I started quite a long time ago, always for me, it's that, and combining different things. So always for me, it's having a cup of tea before I start my day for, you know, half an hour. Now, that might sound a luxury to some people, but let me tell you that even before COVID-19, when I, you know, spent quite a lot of time going out into the workplace, even if I needed to leave at 4:30 in the morning, I'd still set my alarm to get up and do that before I started my day, because I sit quietly, and while I'm having that cup of tea, I'm not meditating as such. I'm not doing a formal breath practice as such, but I'm moving myself into the day whilst having that cup of tea, to just to arrive into that as centered, as grounded, and with the intention for what I wanted to bring to the day. So that for me, that's all the time. That would be part of my day, whatever time I'm getting up. I walk in nature a lot. I'm very, very lucky to have a nature reserve on my doorstep where I live. And so particularly, you know, when we were in lockdown in the UK and we were only allowed out for an hour, I have to say I felt that was a total luxury. Mm-hmm. When I'm planning anything of my workshops or my courses, when I was writing my book, I would walk around the nature reserve, think about my posture, breathe, take in the nature around me. And I would find when I do that, that I just get like a download of inspiration. So that for me is pretty much routine. I'll often bump into people walking around the nature reserve and they'll say to me, "You're not working today." I said, "Oh, I am.
I'm working right now." Yeah.
Absolutely. So that's key for me. I do practice yoga. Not every day, but I certainly am quite in tune with my body in terms of where it feels tight, where I feel I'm holding on to tension.
Yes.
So yoga is quite a big practice for me as well, mainly. And I too am a fan of having a bath.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Okay. No, I like that. I like that. You've got that kind of ritual in the morning of the cup of tea. For me, very recently, that ritual's become stretching. So 1 hour of stretching. I finished David Goggins' book, You Can't Hurt Me, directly after I went to the virtual Tony Robbins, which we spoke about before we hit record. Tony Robbins was saying, you know, put the most important things first. And for me, having poor posture, poor, you know, sucking of the gut, all that stuff. And I was like, well, that has to come first. That has to come before trying to make money through work and, you know, all these different things scrolling through your phone. So I've really tried to go, right, what are the most important things? Let's get those things done first. And again, going back to Tony Robbins, I think he says something like, if you can't find 10 minutes for yourself, you don't have a life. And, you know, I haven't got time to do all these things. And there's an analogy, again, I've got a lot of these corporate analogies that have been kind of put into me over the years through training, but there's these two people pushing a push bike up a hill, and it's got square wheels. So if you've ever heard this, it might be on a Covey book as well. And they're really sweating and they're pushing this bike up the hill, and the wheels are, you know, the square. So they're going up like that and they're really struggling. And there's a guy at the side of the road, and he's got these round bicycle wheels. He's like, "Guys, I've got something for you." And they go, "We haven't got time. We've got to get this bike up the hill." And I often think about that when people say they haven't got time, because I think, well, actually, if you invest now in yourself, isn't that going to pay for itself quite quickly a little bit later on? So that's my analogy that goes into my brain, is the square bicycle wheels. And that always seems to help me. You just mentioned your book. Do you want to talk a bit about what the book's about and give people a bit of a flavour?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Mike. It's called Stress Hacking, 50 Simple Strategies to Get Your Life, Your Mind and Your Mojo Back. I actually wrote it last year when I had no idea, obviously, COVID was coming, but it's really just, 50 simple strategies. It's these, as I mentioned a while ago, I think it's these very easy, practical, doable things that make the difference. I don't know about you. I mean, I've been into this kind of self-development thing since I got into the meditation in the 90s. And I'm a great one myself. I have been over the years for, you know, reading a book. I really love reading books. I love listening to podcasts like yours. I get all inspired. I think that's brilliant. That's going to make such a change. And then I don't do anything.
Yes.
So I've really tried over the years to get out of that pattern. And what I have noticed is it is these really just simple things. You think, well, you know what? I could do that. It's not that big a deal effort wise. And then you start to notice that they make a difference in your life. So just you've said about the stretching. Can I ask you what you've noticed? Have you noticed any difference in how you feel then and what?
I have, yeah. So there's a couple of things going on. So number one, if you haven't read of David Goggins' book or you heard of David Goggins, he's worth checking out because he's a very interesting character. And he basically was dying in the hospital at the end. He was a young, fit guy and something was going on. And he had all these knots all over his body. And he just thought, he had this memory of when he was finishing his military training and they brought a yoga instructor, I think. And they were like, oh, you're tight. You've got like steel going on in between your ligaments. And that's always how I've described my, it feels like it's steel wires. Anyway, he started stretching a couple of hours a day and he started to get better and he was able to leave the hospital. And now he's you know, a very healthy guy again. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because I've had knots in my back. And one of them essentially exploded. I was on a punching bag, and that particular knot that had been there for years and had been quite numb and tingly and pins and needly for years, I was on this punching bag, and I hadn't warmed up properly, and something just snapped. And from that point on to today, I still get spasms in that area. So I'm not sure what's happened. I've seen multiple physiotherapists. Anyway, I started thinking, no one's ever told me to stretch my legs. And it all kind of started to make sense. So hang on, I can't, you know, can't get even close to 20% of being on the splits. All the hips are so tight. And anyway, I've started just putting all this effort into stretching all the lower part out, and then I'll do the upper part. But because I've spent the last 3 years stretching the back out, hasn't made any difference at all. But my legs are so, so tight. So I've been stretching out for about 7 weeks, an hour a day. I think I've only missed two or three out of those 7 weeks. And my girlfriend did it with me yesterday, and she could notice the difference. Now, my back still hasn't changed, but I'm giving myself some breathing space, again, no pun intended, because I think, well, actually, I've got nearly 40 years of bad posture. It's going to take some time, but instinctively I feel like I know this is the path forward for me, because if my legs are tight, and please, I would love to get your advice on this, if my legs and hips and thighs and calves are so tight, surely that's doing something to the rest of the back. And no one's ever mentioned that before, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Right, so my thoughts on that are perhaps not going to be what you've asked me for, but anyway, I'll say it all the same.
Yeah.
As an experiment, I think doing the stretching is great, because, you know, wherever there's tension in the body, you know, we have a connected fascia the whole way through our body. So if one area is tight, has an effect on the other. So yes. I think, yeah, great with the stretching. But there's two things I'm going to suggest as an experiment, if you were up for it.
Yeah, of course.
First of all, I would lay or sit in the most comfortable position you can. For you, whatever that might be, it doesn't matter which it is. And do some breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Inhale through the nose for a count of four. Exhale through the mouth for a count of six. Mm-hmm. If that's comfortable length breath for you. But have the exhalation slightly longer than the inhalation.
Yep.
And as you're exhaling, mentally say to yourself, let go.
Okay.
And then while you're doing that, so you might practice that for, you know, 10 minutes or so.
Yes.
Just that repetitive invitation through the exhalation, let go. And then as you're doing that, maybe just take your awareness into that knot.
Mm-hmm.
And invite that to let go.
Okay.
And you might also, I mean, this is going one step further, but you might also want to see if there's anything to come into your awareness of, what are you trying to tell me? I'm a great believer that the body is trying to tell us something.
Yes.
So I would ask, what's that not about? You know, the other thing that I'm going to suggest, and this I tried myself when I was first got into teaching yoga, I was into very much more the dynamic vinyasa flow style, quite strong, quite dynamic. I really enjoyed that. But a friend of mine taught restorative yoga. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever come across that. It's basically what I described at the time was you just lie down and do nothing for an hour and a half-ish, because you do about five postures.
Yes.
But the thing around it is that all the postures are supported. So there is meant to be no muscular effort at all. So not like yin yoga. Sometimes people get confused with yin and restorative. In yin yoga, there might still be an element of muscular effort or tension, even though the poses are held longer and stiller. But in restorative yoga, the idea is that there should be no effort at all. Mm. Now, for me, when I did that first few classes, I didn't know I had tension in my body to the degree that I did.
Okay.
But I was really humbled, I think is the word, when I did this practice. And you're in these postures for, you know, sometimes 15 minutes or so each one.
Yes.
I couldn't believe how, just when I thought my body had let go of all tension, there was more to go and more to go and more to go. And so it was a real eye-opener for me of, golly, I'm really, there is a lot of tension in my body that I don't even know I'm carrying. So that just allowing the body the time to let go of that tension.
Okay, I will check that out. Yeah, I did one restorative class in Bali. I spent a month in Bali last year, and it was towards the end when we were leaving. We took a class, and yeah, I think there was four poses we did in an hour. And it was, I did one class. It's not enough to get a sense, but I'll definitely do those experiments and I'll report back on it.
Let me know.
Yeah,
you might, find in the restorative yoga, it's a bit like you were saying with the meditation though, you know what, for somebody that has a lot going on, the mind can get busy again while you're in those postures. So sometimes it's a case of just that constant invitation to the mind. It's okay.
It's okay.
We'll just be here. It's all right.
No, wonderful. Well, thank you. No, thank you for that gift. I really appreciate that. And with the letting go, you're not verbalizing that. You're saying that in your mind, are you? As you exhale, you're saying that piece. Okay.
Yeah. And you know, that is another practice, a beautiful one to go just before you try and get to sleep at night. I think it's another lovely one for us to let go of the day.
Yes.
You know, whether it's been good, bad, indifferent, just that we're done now. Like, yes. I'm in bed now. I'm just letting that day go.
Yeah. Wonderful. I was just going to ask you, you talked about nature. It just wanted to say something back, actually, which was, have you done much grounding in the past? Have you messed about with that at all?
In terms of when I first got into meditation, and the people that I learnt with were very much into different energy, and they did sort of an element of grounding. So in that context, yes, that was more just thinking about that barefoot. I know you've talked about barefoot on the earth, and I think there's a lot in that as well. So mainly now, the grounding for me is more of a centering than grounding. That feels just being steady within my state of being.
Mm.
And that naturally feels grounded.
Okay. Yeah. So it's...
What about you?
It's something I don't know a great deal about. I've spoken to Tim Gray, who was on a couple of episodes ago, and I think he spent £1 million on his own health. And he said something like all of that money and all of that time. I think what he said was some of the best practices he'd learned were the free ones, but he'd gone through that journey, and kind of makes sense, you know, breathing and meditation and that sort of thing. But he was talking about grounding. And then I've listened to some other podcasts with some other experts about it. And just this piece around we're animals and, you know, we've cut ourselves off from the planet. And to me, it's always very, very woo-woo. It's like, grounding. But then when you start to think about it, there's all these magnetic forces and, you know, we're removed from the earth. We've got rubber soles in our shoes. And there's something else I don't quite understand about when the sun's hitting us. If we're grounded, there's an extra power there where there's a transference back into the earth through us. So it's just something I'm starting to learn about, but I'm trying to do that every day. And would I say I feel different? Possibly not. Maybe there's a bit of placebo going on there, but I'll go and do, you know, some press-ups and some bits and bobs on the grass in the garden, and I'll do that barefoot and then go upstairs and, you know, you get a bit muddy so you can have a shower. But there's just this thing of going, oh, I've just done something good for myself there. I've just given myself that time on the ground, which most people don't give. So I don't know. It's just something I was just curious to learn more about, and I'm trying to go on that journey now.
Yeah, I think nature in general is incredibly healing, healing. And, you know, I noticed that particularly, you know, as I say, living by the nature reserve, when I've been busy in, you know, pre-COVID, when I might have back-to-back days in organisations and not get as much time to do that, when I then went for the first walk after that, I can literally energetically feel that expansion happening again, that steadying of the breath. So yes. I think, which has been, to me, has been one of the interesting things about certainly in the UK with COVID, is that more people, because of the restrictions to not go out, it was interesting seeing the amount of people I spoke to in several of the webinars I was doing that said they'd never exercised in their life, but because of the restriction when we were in lockdown of only being allowed out for an hour a day, they started to go for a walk in nature. And only because they were restricted, they would never have done it otherwise. And having done that, they said they just couldn't believe how much better they felt. So even that, you know, I'm a great believer with all these things. You know, you call it the placebo effect, but for me, I think if something tangibly, noticeably helps us, why wouldn't we choose that?
Yes, 100% agree.
However that's happening, it doesn't matter, does it? No. It's like, it's better.
Yes, yeah. If it makes us feel better, then, you know, fantastic. And again, you know, most of these things are free, aren't they? You know, going for a walk in nature, getting some daylight. Again, there's this other podcast I listened to where the chap was talking about we're inside 80s, 90%. I think it's above 90% of our time. We don't get any daylight on us, you know, and then we cover our solar panels. They're all covered up. So when we do go out, we might just get a little bit of light on the face, you know, and we're designed again to be touching the earth and to be getting all this daylight all over us. And it's another reason why there's anxiety and depression possibly.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And even the fact of the impact that has on our sleep patterns.
Yeah.
You know, don't know if you've read, I'm sure you have, Why We Sleep, Matthew Walker.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the evidence is there now, isn't it? Of this getting outside, exercising outside.
Yeah.
Sunlight.
That book ruined my sleep for at least a month because I was so stressed about not getting, you know, they talk about Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan getting a few hours of sleep and having Alzheimer's. And I was like, oh my God, I need to get 8 hours. And I was getting really stressed before bed. Oh my God, there's less than 8 hours left now. And eventually, thankfully, I relaxed into it and now it's not a problem, but it had the opposite effect on me for a little bit.
Me too, Mike. Honestly, I did quite a lot of research around sleep because of obviously working with people with well-being, and I spent considerable months doing it. And yeah, like you, I actually said to people, I've done this research to try and help people that don't sleep well, which often does go with stress. And I said, I have to admit, even I feel a bit stressed having done the research. You know, but as you say, it's just you come out the other side of that. I think the takeaway to that initial horror, if you like, is just to really recognize the importance of sleep. Yes. And I think it is one of those things we can cut the corners of.
Yes.
And of course, there's times in people's lives when they're just not going to get enough sleep. And that's a given. You know, if they've just had a new child, for example, and, you know, they're being woken up all night, there's nothing they can do about that. But I do think in general, our lifestyles, we could give the opportunity at least to have better sleep.
Yes.
And the knock-on effects of that on all levels are incredible, aren't they?
Yeah. And it's shocking to me how so many people don't value sleep. And it's like, well, I can get by on 5 hours. Let's get by. Or I don't need more than 6 hours. I'm one of those people that doesn't need, you know, 8 hours of sleep. And then I think it's in Matthew Walker's research. It's like, if we were to account for that as a percentage, it wouldn't even register as a 0.1, I think, the amount of people that can get by on less than 8 hours worth of sleep. Because evolutionary speaking, we're designed. So we need to get more sleep and good sleep as well. So just coming towards the end, a couple of last questions for you then, Louise. So what would be your top tips for people to become healthier, grounded, more mindful? What sort of things would you recommend?
I think the single breath practice would be my top tip of just hold on a minute, bring yourself back into the moment you're in, take that deep breath. Because if we can do that, you know, I think particularly around stress, a lot of the stress that people suffer or anxiety, it's because we are literally carrying, you know, the past, the future, now, everything all with us in every moment. And of course, that's overwhelming. But the reality is, if we just strip that back to taking life, you know, one day at a time, one moment at a time. And I'm not saying that that means we don't plan, you know, have goals. I'm all for that. But let's remember to just take that deep breath and come back to, what am I doing now? Mm. How am I being now? And I often say this to people, you know, when they're, you know, this, oh, I'm so busy, I haven't got time for this, as you said earlier. Like, where are you racing to?
Yes.
When do you get there? Because that's the irony. If we don't learn to be here now, then wherever it is we're racing to or whatever it is we're trying to achieve, it's highly likely when we get to that point, we won't notice it because we're already chasing after the next. So there's something about that balance, I think, of marrying all of that together with we are actually living now, believe it or not.
Yes.
So taking that deep breath, single breath practice is probably my top kick.
No, that's wonderful. And again, just having this conversation with you consciously, I know now that I'm going to have a lovely Sunday afternoon because I'm not racing anywhere. I've got, you know, nothing needs doing today. I'm just going to relax and go for a walk. So thank you. Where can people find you? Where can they find your book? Where are you on social media? All that stuff, please.
Yeah, right. So my website, louiselloyd.life, that's the best place to get a hold of me. And I'm on Facebook a little bit called The Inspired Zone. And that's those two places. LinkedIn is mainly through work. That's where I post most of my stuff. And the book is available on Amazon. We can put the link up if you like.
Yeah, we'll do that. Yeah, we'll be down here, guys. Yeah.
Fab. And so that's it, mainly. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, I feel like we've still got lots to talk about. So I'd love to do a part two with you at some point because I feel like we've only just scratched the surface today and we'll have to arrange another one. But for now, thank you so much for being on the Breathcast. It has been a real value add for me and hopefully for our audience as well. And I will absolutely be going away and doing this experiment of the breathing and the other piece, which was the, what was the piece you suggested? It was breathing and...
Yeah, the let go breath practice. And maybe the restorative
yoga. Yes, I'll go back and write that down. Yeah, so I will find an online restorative yoga practice. That'll be wonderful. Right, well, wonderful. Once again, thank you so much. And guys, thanks for watching, and we'll see you on the next Breathcast. Thanks, Louise.
Thanks, Mike.
Cheers.